Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, discussion of healthcare and science in the news, answers to your questions about these things, and also your emails. So I hope you'll stay tuned right by that radio for the next hour for Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I wanted to start out with a very important news story, something that with all of the hurly-burly about healthcare maybe went under the radar for most of us, but this will have at least, I think, as fundamental an effect on our healthcare over the next couple of decades as the healthcare reform first steps that were taken last week. Now, that's a pretty heavy-duty statement. Why would I say that this will have as profound an effect? Well, because it's pretty darn important. This is around the concept of patenting genes. And in a landmark court decision this week, the court ruled that 7 of 23 patents involving genes tied to breast and ovarian cancers should not have been granted. Now, this does very bad things for the stock of a biotech company called Myriad that holds the patents on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. These have been associated with breast cancer and are widely used. The test itself costs almost $3,000, and no lab but Myriad is allowed to do it. Nobody can do research on these two genes because the patents that were granted were so broad that they effectively gave ownership of the genes and all potential research on them to this company. Now, this has been a trend in science, or rather, it's been a trend in commerce in this country for the last 15 years especially. There have been patents granted for all sorts of genes, and it's just a plain dumb idea to give a patent. It's like someone is digging in the ground and they find a new mineral and they get to patent it. And anyone who else on the planet who digs it and finds this mineral has to pay them a royalty. It's crazy. They didn't invent. They found it. So patents just shouldn't apply. But during all of those years of deregulation that we've been through, a whole lot of patents were granted. And now we have a foot in the door in terms of maybe making that a bit more rational. The human genome, your human genome, as far as that's concerned, it doesn't really belong to you. If you happen to have a cancer growing in your body, I'm very sorry for you, but if somebody takes that cancer and uses it to create an immortal cell line, that's not your property either. And that's something that belongs to the human race as a whole. The human genome belongs to the human race, and we shouldn't parcel it out, patent it, or otherwise fence it off. This is in the way of everyone's long-term best interest as a species. Now, your short-term good interest as a stockholder may be a different story, but hey, it's the whole human race that makes the laws for the human race. So you know what? We need to take back the genome. We need to take back those patents. Sure, let's give people who do research a fair return on their investment. I think we've figured out how to do that. I don't think it has to be in perpetuity. And the amount of restrictions on research and the cost of tests that might otherwise be done much more widely and save lives really needs to be considered. So just a little bit of good news from the courts. This is something that, of course, will be appealed, and it'll be another 5 years probably before this particular issue is settled. But where this is going to have a profound effect is going forward with new patents, because those really broad patents have probably ended, and that, I think, is a very good thing. I'm going to go to a couple of emails. Let's start with Jill in Aptos. Jill writes, "My MD says he thinks I have something called Sjogren's disease. I've been feeling lousy on and off for many years, and we finally see that my ANA, that's anti-nuclear antibody, indicates that I have one of these charming autoimmune diseases. Have you any idea on how I can keep from having such incredible exhaustion and pain? I'm not wanting to take steroids, but maybe that will set this into some sort of dormancy. Do you know anything about a diet or helpful herb, acupuncture, or what? Jill goes on to tell us that she eats well, not too much meat, lots of veggies, bread, a slice every 2 or 3 days, granola, soy milk, can't tolerate regular milk, not a smoker, not a drinker. And she goes on to give some specifics about how healthy she used to be and how bad she's felt. She's also having lots of hot flashes, and she does not want to take Prometrium and all those one-size-fits-all hormones. She says she's on a compounded bioidentical hormone, but she can't wean off. So, first of all, Jill, on the subject of autoimmune disease, you're living a healthy lifestyle. That's a wonderful thing. Now, let's add to it checking and making sure that your healthy lifestyle is actually doing its work. One thing I would strongly suggest, because you have shown up with an autoimmune disease, is getting a vitamin D level checked. In general, I am currently recommending to people, and I would say this is a conservative recommendation in the alternative world and a fairly aggressive recommendation if you listen to the think tanks that are generally 5 to 10 years behind the research. So what the research tells us is that you can probably safely take up to 10,000 units a day of vitamin D, unless you have certain very rare medical conditions, in which case that's a problem. So how do you figure that out? You monitor your calcium level and your serum 25-hydroxy vitamin D. And I would say getting your 25-hydroxy vitamin D up till the 60 to 70 range would be a very good idea. Since you live in Aptos, the fog capital of the Monterey Bay, I can virtually guarantee that unless you're taking very high supplementation right now, you probably have a suboptimal vitamin D. You may even be below 30, which is really the lowest threshold anyone should let themselves fall below. Vitamin D isn't just about your bones. It controls something called the vitamin D receptor, which is one of those epigenetic receptors that promotes and turns on certain DNA, and the DNA, it turns out, has a lot to do with how the immune system works. Vitamin D levels are disproportionately low in people who develop autoimmune diseases. So going back and fixing the vitamin D level may have an ameliorating effect on your autoimmune disease. And there is some preliminary research that suggests that. But because autoimmune diseases go up and down, it's very difficult to do research on them and prove conclusively that when you change variables such as vitamin D levels, you've actually modified things for the patient. A second thing I wanted to emphasize, since you're describing so much exhaustion and pain, is you really need to fix your hormones. At this point, I think you're being a little bit fastidious on the hormone replacement therapy. Yes, continue to get regular mammograms. I think you should consider using the Prometrium or at least a compounded progesterone to balance the other thing I'm about to suggest, which is increasing your hormone levels to the high end of what's considered normal for a postmenopausal woman. Not long term, just short term, to see how much improvement you get in your symptoms. To the extent that your symptoms are related to estrogen deficiency, that would be an easy fix and might make you feel a lot better. So I hope this advice has been helpful. Feel free to write again. Let's go now to Anonymous in Seaside.
Good morning. I have a question about Lyme's disease, and I don't have Lyme's disease, but I'd like to tell you a story, and then I'm just going to hang up and you can just sort of riff on this.
Okay.
But there's somebody in my neighborhood, a young man, he was about 22 years old at the time, hiker, got bit by a tick, knew at some point early on that he had Lyme's disease, didn't get treated, partly because young and dumb, no health insurance, something like that. Now, 3 years later, he's getting IV antibiotics, and I guess he's very debilitated. So my question is, if you have an infection like that that's untreated for that long a period of time, you know, what permanent damage has he done?
Okay. Well, let's go back to when Lyme disease is first being identified, which is late 70s, early 80s, I believe, on the East Coast. and it was identified because of a cluster of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, an autoimmune disease, which isn't generally something catching. And yet it was looking like something catching. It was showing up in one community. It was showing up in, you know, kind of widening diameter of cases, just like you'd expect if something could be contagious. Well, it isn't contagious from human to human, but we now know that it's carried by ticks. And so once that was identified, several other pockets showed up. And of course, all of the people who were identified as having this disease initially were people who'd had it for a long time. So we actually know a fair amount about untreated Lyme disease. The way Lyme disease works is it's kind of progressive. It starts out in the skin from the tick bite, and then it spreads through the body. And often one of the early manifestations is not the joints, which was the way that it was identified, but actually carditis, or an inflammation of the heart. So irregular heartbeats, arrhythmias, things like that. Much of those went completely under the radar and still do. Unusual heart arrhythmias, particularly in a young person, you start looking for it. After that, the Lyme disease can go both to the joints and to the nerves. And I'm actually not sure if it's joints and then nerves or vice versa, but I do know that neurologic Lyme disease is one of the other sorts of red flags. So if someone shows up with a Bell's palsy, for example, which is a kind of facial paralysis, particularly if they have that on two sides of their face, it's a red flag to go looking for Lyme disease, particularly if you're in a Lyme endemic area. Because it can infect the brain and the nervous tissues of the central nervous system, it can cause pain, it can cause impaired cognition, and of course, very, very fatigued and depressed kinds of symptomology go along with it. Not to mention the joint manifestations, which look very much like an inflammatory arthritis. So all of that being said, those are the classic sorts of untreated Lyme disease cases. The person giving him the IV antibiotics may have made an accurate diagnosis, or they may have said, here, you have these symptoms, and this fits with this picture of chronic Lyme disease, so you probably have chronic Lyme disease, so here, take these expensive IV antibiotics. And unfortunately, there are some practitioners who I think are somewhat over-inclusive in who they will treat. Since you can't, with Lyme disease in particular, prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that someone doesn't have Lyme disease, you do run into situations where people say, well, I've got chronic Lyme disease and I'm on these long-term antibiotics and I'm no better. And I'm like, well, maybe you don't actually have Lyme disease. And no, I'm just not on the right antibiotic. And it's like, okay, this is a useless conversation. I don't know what to say to help you. So I hope that your friend isn't in that situation. And
I think he actually got a positive diagnosis early on.
Okay, that's good, because a positive diagnosis early on is much more credible before antibiotics are given. The positive blood tests then are useful. After antibiotics are given, a negative blood test doesn't necessarily rule out the disease, which is why it's so problematic. But not getting treated was, if that was the case, was a bad move on his part. And
yes, it's turned out to be very bad. But my question is, you know, I actually looked this up and saw that it was caused by a spirochete.
That's correct. Similar to the one that causes syphilis.
Yes. So, you know, thinking down the line here, if someone had syphilis, they wouldn't say, oh, I'll just treat it with something natural, whatever that might be. And it would be a disease that would progress and there would be long-term consequences, right?
Well, let's hit the reverse button and go back 100 years when there weren't any antibiotics to speak of for treating syphilis. There were things like mercuric chloride, which was used, killed the syphilis, but it practically killed you. It was an extremely nasty treatment. But mostly there wasn't something. And so people who got syphilis suffered long-term deterioration. Many of them developed essentially a dementia, effect, quote-unquote, went mad.
Right.
And you will develop a loss of sensation in your lower extremities. People will develop something, sometimes a Charcot joint. In other words, they can't feel their feet. The spinal column's been affected, so they get a bad neuropathy. They can't feel their feet. So in order to know that they're standing, they get in the habit of stomping, and they stomp so hard they turn the joint into powder.
Mm.
And so they completely trash their ankle joints. Those are things, if you go into the 1930s medical textbooks, you can find lots of photos of these things. And of course, the problems of people who had syphilis and then get pregnant and have a baby, and the baby's born with syphilis, and there's all sorts of horrible birth defects that are associated with it. I would say Lyme disease is a much, much kinder and gentler spirochete in terms of the long-term damage it's caused. It's not to say it's fun to have it, but compared to syphilis, it's a walk in the park.
But with antibiotics, this person could be cured and...
And whatever damage is done to, say, the surface of the joints
yeah.
or the nerves themselves may not recover fully.
Okay, that was my question.
Yeah.
All right, so people should probably get treated early.
If you have a positive test for Lyme disease, you should get treated early. And you haven't been treated, and you've got some kind of manifestation like the rash, the target lesion, or a fever with a flu-like illness within a couple of weeks of a tick bite. I mean, that's what I always tell people who come in with the tick bite. It's like, okay, we'll take the tick out. How long was it on? Under 24 hours. Okay, the chances are you weren't infected. Even if you were hiking in our most tick-infested area, which is probably Nicene Marks at about 15% of ticks being positive in some studies, even if you're there and you get a tick bite, if you find it and get it off within 24 hours, the chances are astronomically low of actually getting Lyme disease from that tick bite. So sit tight, take your temperature every day. If you get a fever or the flu in the next 2 weeks, we're going to treat you. And that's kind of my little speech that I give to patients.
Okay, well, hopefully a lot of people have heard it and they will avoid the consequences of letting it go.
And we're getting into tick season, so it's like, hello, folks, when you hike, you know, wear white socks, tuck your pants into your socks if you're going through grass. When you get home after your hike, get naked in a bright light. Yes, I know it's difficult, but get naked in a bright light and look for little black ticks. Okay. Thank you for the call.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Deborah in Santa Cruz. Hello, Deborah. Thank you for the call.
Hi. Hi, this is a follow-up call from last week. I talked to you about my husband and these mysterious bug bites.
Uh-huh, the guy who's worked at the hospital.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other people also had them.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's come back is you told me to do the big X on his back.
Yeah.
And that didn't get red.
Okay.
And I found out that he has had a biopsy, and they just said it was benign. They did a punch biopsy of one of them, and he's seen two dermatologists in the same office, and they think it's some kind of bug bite.
Okay. Well, there are certain characteristics, histopathological characteristics, that will appear in the description of his bug bite. Not in the bottom, because, you know, usually when you send a punch biopsy and what you're asking is, you know, is this a cancer? So it'll say no malignancy. But what you want to do is read the description of it and see if there is a lymphocytic infiltrate.
Lymphocytic infiltrate.
Right. That's what you characteristically would see with a bug bite.
Okay.
All right. So we're no closer to figuring out what this mysterious bug is.
No.
Okay. And you have confirmed that there are other people in the...
Three that he knows of, but it's not like he's gone around and asked.
Why not?
I'm not sure. I encouraged him to do that, but... Yeah.
Take them aside and also find out, did it manage to make it home to any of their partners?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Because then I'm really thinking it's some kind of bite, and I don't know, I think bed bugs, but, I mean, they usually reside in beds. I haven't heard too much about bed bugs jumping from person to person in a work setting, unless they make a habit of doing group hugs.
No group hugs.
Okay, just masking.
And I don't have them, and we sleep together, so.
Oh, I thought you said you had gotten one.
I had gotten, like, one or two, but they never manifest the same way. It's more like this feeling of being stung for out of nowhere. And I get this tiny welt, and then it's gone immediately. But his aren't. His lasts for days, itchy.
Don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, thanks for the follow-up. At least we've ruled out food sensitivity, which is what I wanted to do.
Would you think that he should try going somewhere else? If we can read this description, that, like, would going to Stanford or UCSF, or can you recommend anywhere else to follow up?
Well, I think that having the slides sent off to the folks at Stanford with the question of, is this anyway characteristic of a particular insect?
Okay.
But there, what they'll do is maybe some special stains, or at least, you know, they'll put their bug guy on it.
Right.
And that might be useful.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you
Bye-bye.
So much. Bye.
Let's go to line 4, Anonymous in Santa Cruz.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How can I help you today?
Well, first, I just want to tell you how much I enjoy your show and how much I appreciate the service that you give to people. It's amazing that we have this resource.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is difficult for me to talk about, but I'm a very highly functional alcoholic. I've always drunk in moderation my entire life, and then a little over 3 years ago, I had a very traumatic experience in my life, and I turned to alcohol. And I came out of that about a year and a half later, and I was fine. And then about a year ago, I had another very traumatic experience. Both of these were deaths of people that I cared about. And so, as I said, it's been a little over a year now, and I can't seem to get out of the alcohol spiral now. And what I'm wondering is there any kind of naturopathic remedy to decrease cravings?
Okay, let me ask a couple of details about your drinking pattern. There are two types of alcoholic drinking patterns. One is daily heavy use, and the other is abstinence for 3 days, 7 days, 10 days, and then a binge.
Daily heavy use.
Okay, and that consists of how many drinks?
About a dozen.
About a dozen, okay. So you are in the situation of having a high risk for pretty significant withdrawal symptoms, even DTs. When you've quit drinking in the past, from your description, I'm inferring that you've quit drinking in the past completely and been sober for periods of time.
Yes.
Did you ever have DTs or seizures?
Very mild symptoms, as in sweating and maybe a little shakiness.
Okay, you're lucky, because at that level of consumption, a lot of people would have much more severe withdrawal symptoms.
Okay.
So I think that the best drugs for reducing cravings is actually Campral, which is not homeopathic. It's a heavy drug. It's a real pharmaceutical, real live expensive pharmaceutical. But it does have a good track record in terms of that. You should look for someone who can do acupuncture. There are a couple of acupuncture points that reduce cravings, and ear acupuncture might be great. They could put some points in your ear. These are used for heroin and narcotic withdrawal with a great deal of success.
I never heard of that. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's actually become a standard part of most state or, you know, when you get in trouble with the law and they say you have to go to a treatment program, most of these treatment programs use these ear needles as part of their standard. So I don't know if the local acupuncture college here in town has a specific program, but you could certainly ask them. I know that they would know how to do the ear acupuncture points and probably welcome the opportunity to teach it to their students. And they're cheap. So compared to going to a licensed acupuncturist in private practice, you basically get half price by going to their clinic, kind of like getting your hair cut at the barber college.
Okay.
So I think you could start with that. There are probably Chinese herbs as well. I mean, alcohol's been around for 10,000 years, and so Chinese medicine's been around for 3,000, and they wrote everything down. So they've probably got some protocols that I don't know about. In terms of homeopathy, I'm not sure. If the homeopathic person, if you saw a real one who like did your individualized case, they might be able to find the perfect remedy that would help. But I don't think any of the on-the-shelf, kind of out-of-a-textbook homeopathic things are going to have enough power. Unless you get just extremely randomly lucky, I don't think they're going to have the kind of personal power that it's going to take for this. The other thing is, don't try to go this alone. I mean, you really need to get involved in a 12-step program and step up to the plate every morning, look in the mirror and say, I'm an alcoholic and I'm asking for help from a higher power to stop this, because that's how you do it. That's your shot at success, is to basically ask for help from the universe, whether you call it God or whether you call it, you know, the Big Bang or world spirit or whatever. You need help from outside yourself to get out of this hole.
Yeah. Not recently, but a while back, I was really beating myself up for this. How can I be so weak over something as stupid as alcohol? And then I came to the conclusion that it's not on a conscious level. It's on a cellular level. This is very difficult.
Yes, I know. It's extremely difficult. And anyone who's ever been down this path before you, and there are plenty of people who will talk to you about it, will tell you that it's really is a matter of one day at a time, and every single day getting up and making the commitment that at least today, no matter what happens, I'm just going to get through today without drinking.
Yeah.
And each day is still hard. 20 years out, each day is still hard.
Yeah.
But that's your route, you know, this way out, man. There it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Bye.
Bye. Let's go to Anna in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anna, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm 50 and recently had my first colonoscopy, but it turned out to be an attempt. And I'm confused or curious about why it didn't work. I had the appointment scheduled for 2 o'clock on a Monday, so I started the movie prep thing on Sunday morning, did everything by the book. I'm pretty educated at working clinics. I know what I'm doing. And I didn't even start taking until about 3 hours before the appointment. I didn't have any effect from it.
Mm.
And then by the time I got there, well, finally, I was, you know, pretty much having diarrhea nonstop.
Right, but I wasn't done.
And I told them that I wasn't. And they said, oh, well, we'll just do an enema. And, of course, that wasn't enough. And they gave me more, you know, the sedative and the IV and everything. And by the time I got in there, of course, they said, oh, you have retained stool in a kind of punitive way. Then they wanted me to right away schedule it again, which I didn't want to do because I didn't like what I was putting all those foreign substances and chemicals in my body. So I'm just wondering why it wouldn't have taken.
Well, a couple of reasons, one of which is what you may have a naturally slow transit time. Are you on any medications?
No.
Okay.
I'm very healthy. I eat a lot of vegetables.
And you don't normally have constipation?
No, I have a slower metabolism than, you know, my husband.
Okay. Well, some people are a little naturally slower than others. If a person's somewhat dehydrated, they can have a slower response, and some people just naturally do. These agents, by the way, the whole point of them is they're not absorbed. They're not getting into your bloodstream. They aren't going to affect your body at a distance. The whole purpose of them is they're big molecules. They sit in your colon, and they suck fluid from your bloodstream into the colon, and that's how they make you have diarrhea so that you can clean out all the stool in the colon and get a good look.
Mm-hmm.
So, number one, don't be worried about doing another prep right away. You're not going to hurt your health.
Okay.
The first thing, that's number one. Number two is when you reschedule and go back in, heavy, heavy hydration for 3 or 4 days before. Whatever is your normal fluid intake, double it.
Okay.
And just go into, like, fluid overload deliberately.
Oh, okay.
So that there's so much fluid that when you start drinking this stuff, the body goes, somewhere else to put it.
Okay. Because I did drink a lot those 2 days they told me to. But more before.
But even more, because the first time, you get average advice the first time. If average advice doesn't work, then you amp it up. So what we're doing is amping it up.
Okay.
Since you don't think you were dehydrated, I'm going to have you hyperhydrate.
Yeah.
And I'm suggesting, you know, just not worrying that you're going to hurt your body by doing this again. And maybe start the prep earlier and go through, like, let's say you're doing it Monday, start the prep on Saturday, and then just do nothing but clear liquids all day Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So that it has more time to work.
Okay. 2 nights that way then.
Yeah, well, you probably won't have the diarrhea for more than 12 hours.
Well, I mean, two nights.
But you'll be on the fluids after you clean out so that you don't fill back up again.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, all right.
That sounds simple. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
Well, in the aftermath of the healthcare legislation that was passed last week, I wanted to present just a quick digest of the news stories that came out and try to point out some, the devil is always in the details, isn't it? So first of all, there was a nice article on MSNBC.com about the top 7 healthcare fears, most of which are not true. So we're not going to have rationing of healthcare in the elderly because of comparative effectiveness research. Not likely. Cuts in Medicare Advantage will cause massive disruption for more than 10 million seniors. No, what it will do is it will let the companies who are currently making about 14% more per person from the government than the rest of us get for Medicare, give them notice that's going to go away and slowly ramp it back down. People will have less preventative coverage. They'll only get towards the end, say in 10 years, they're pretty much only going to get what Medicare pays for and not extra stuff. Will the IRS ramp up now that they have to send people to jail for not getting health insurance? Well, no, the IRS will not be doing that. actually the IRS will not be doing any of the verification. That'll be up to the Department of Health and Human Services. Will people wait longer to see a primary care doctor? Well, if they are insisting on an MD, this one's probably true. If we put another 40 million people into an already overstressed primary care system, something's got to give. Even if we were to suddenly make a primary care doctor make the same income as a specialist, which would require doubling most primary care doctors' income, we would still have to wait for 3 to 5 years for those primary care doctors to come out of the pipeline. People have been walking away from primary care in droves for the last 2 decades because the work is hard and the pay is low. And guess what? That's pretty much a recipe for declining enrollments. So what will we see? We're going to see more physician extenders, more nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. And I have to tell you, working with both types of professionals over my career, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It could, in the long run, lead to an improvement in people's health care because more of the preventative work will be done. Will we have an elimination of TRICARE? That's the military health insurance. No, because that meets the criteria for a minimum health plan. Will federal employees be forced to switch their health insurance coverage and participate in the exchanges? No, unless you're a member of Congress or one of their personal staffs, in which case, damn straight you should have to be in the exchanges. I want you and your children to be getting the exact same care as I, as an independent entrepreneur, have to purchase. That's what I want. I want you to be in the trenches with the rest of us, because then I know it's going to keep you honest the next appropriations round. Because, hey, your daughter's going to go to the same clinic to get her vaccinations. And that should be a price of being in public office, as far as I'm concerned. So I was just so happy to see that be part of the legislation. Myth number 7, illegal immigrants will get free health care, and that's a problem. They are currently getting free health care. They're getting free health care when they show up in distress, in urgent, dire straits, in an emergency room, and they're getting some of the most expensive free care there is. So, unfortunately, to satisfy the interests of conservative Democrats in southern states, that's still going to be the status quo. But at least for the hospitals and the doctors who are absorbing the costs of that free care, they will get more reimbursement for taking care of the other people who are currently getting free high-cost emergency care because they have no health insurance. That group is going to go away. And hopefully the income that institutions and individual providers make from that group will help offset the continued hemorrhage from the illegal, quote-unquote, illegal immigrant population. Personally, I think they should be allowed to buy health care from the exchanges. Just don't give them a subsidy. What's wrong with that? It just strengthens the exchanges. But hey, that's a sensible thought. Now, having gone on the 7 myths, I also do want to point out that there's going to be a lot of wiggling and squirming, and it's already starting. There's a wonderful story on ABC News by Lauren Cox and Laura Salahi about a 12-day-old baby boy named Houston Tracy. I'm sure you can Google this child. He was born with the major blood vessels in his heart reversed, and guess what? He can't get health insurance. His parents were denied when they tried to enroll him in the same health insurance plan they have for both of their other children. Turns out the parents can't afford health insurance themselves, but they have been purchasing it for their other kids. They couldn't get it for this one. He has a pre-existing condition. And the health plans are already saying that just because we can't exclude you on the basis of pre-existing, that doesn't mean we have to issue you insurance. Sure sounds like may not impose any pre-existing condition exclusion with respect to such plan or coverage. Sounds to me like that means you got to take them if they're kids. But hey, lawyers will be arguing that one for a few years, I'm sure. That's how it goes. Let's go to Linda in Santa Cruz. Hello, Linda. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much. Thanks for running down that list that you just did in terms of what we can expect in healthcare. And just quickly, in terms of the indigent illegal immigrants that are receiving care, do you happen to know if there'll be any change in their receiving prenatal care, which is not exactly emergency care, but I used to, as an NP, I used to work with that population extensively, and they were able to...
Yeah, they can get prenatal care because it's a very practical decision on the part of the state. It's kind of like, you know, this baby's going to be born here. That'll make him a citizen, and we're going to be picking up the tab at that point. So maybe we should try to keep that baby as healthy as possible.
Yeah, I know what
you mean. So the logic is good. I think you could extend it to a lot of other children who maybe cross the border but are in school. But, hey, that's just me.
Andy, I had a quick question as well. In terms of small offices, there's supposed to be some change in the law in order to be able to pay less for your employees. I think it's under, if you have under 50 employees, the laws have changed.
If you have under 50 employees and you are not required to have health insurance, and there's no penalty for not having it, but there are going to be some fairly significant tax breaks.
Right, that's what I was interested in.
For doing it, which will offset, the numbers look like about 35 to 65% of your cost of providing the insurance. So it's still going to cost you money as an employer, but it will cost you a lot less, and you'll be able to purchase through these exchanges.
And that way, I believe, is going to be available in about 6 months, right? You don't have to wait until 2014.
No. What's going to happen in 6 months is that if you are very high risk, if you have pre-existing condition and you're an adult,
right,
and you are essentially what I call an insurance leper, then you will be able to purchase insurance through a high-risk pool that they're going to be setting up.
Mm-hmm. So nothing in terms of the...
The exchanges are going to take... They're going to take 4 years. I mean, that's 4 years is actually pretty fast. It's going to take a while to get this together.
But in terms of the subsidy or the return in
tax dollars
for offices,
I haven't seen any dates for when that's going to happen. But I expect that that may happen a little sooner. But I haven't seen any dates for that. I wouldn't count on anything till 2014.
Yeah, I heard it was about 6 months, along with a few. The
I might be wrong on that.
Your...
I haven't seen that one way or another.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Word is out that you will be seeing ads on television for Crestor, pushing it for people who do not have elevated cholesterol. Hey, what's that? What's the paradox? Well, a study recently published showed that if you have a high HSCRP, which is a blood test showing inflammation, and you are over 55 for a male or over 65 for a female, and you take Crestor, that you will decrease your risk of a heart attack or a stroke. Now, this is a beautiful case of how do you frame the numbers? Because if you run the numbers one way, there's a 55% decrease in heart attack in this group. Wow. Now, there's another problem with that, which is that there's a 55% decrease of a very, very, very small number. So in actual round numbers, you have to give 500 people daily Crestor to prevent one heart attack. And at $3.50 a pill a day, that's a serious chunk of change. So it works out that you have to treat 500 people. You have to spend a lot of money per person. It's going to cost $650,000 per heart attack prevented if this great breakthrough on treating inflammation were promoted. That's a pretty expensive cost to prevent an MI. That's 10 times the cost of preventing MIs in high-risk groups that have high cholesterol. And that's debatable as far as the benefit. Treating 50 people to prevent one heart attack. Treating 500 is absurd. Plus, a recent study published in The Lancet looking at collected data from all of the statin studies found a rather surprising 9% increase in diabetes risk. So just to throw in to the statin study that I just mentioned, if we gave everybody Crestor, it would cost $650,000 to prevent one heart attack. And for every heart attack prevented, we'd have two excess cases of diabetes. Just putting it all in perspective, using statins, whether they are generic or expensive and well advertised, to treat heart attacks in people whose only risk factor is age plus an elevated inflammatory marker is not a good use of funds, and it has more side effects than benefit. Let's go now to Anonymous in Aptos.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to tell you that we met in a very special store in Watsonville when I was buying suits to go teach at a university in Albania.
Oh, yes. I remember that.
Long time ago.
Long time ago. But the suits in Albania definitely rings a bell. How'd that go?
Oh, it was fantastic. Just a beautiful country and a really wonderful experience. But I have a question about Parkinson's.
Okay.
I'm wondering about breathlessness in combination with Parkinson's. And my mother's been checked out for heart function and oxygen levels, and she's going to have a pulmonary test.
Mm-hmm.
But she's very breathless.
I am not aware of a connection between breathlessness per se and Parkinson's disease. It doesn't usually affect diaphragmatic function.
Uh-huh.
Or the chest wall muscles. Those are controlled by different areas of the brain, not related to the movement areas that are affected in Parkinson's.
Uh-huh.
It could be just a comorbidity. In other words, she's an elder and she's developing some heart failure. I would look at an echocardiogram soon and get an ejection fraction and pulmonary function testing.
Right. That's scheduled for next week. So I just thought I'd ask because I was wondering about the breakdown of muscular ability and that kind of thing.
No, it's not a peripheral disease. It's really a central disease.
Uh-huh.
And doesn't affect the diaphragm so far as I have ever seen clinically.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Judith in Watsonville. Hello, Judith. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to, since the issue of Lyme disease came up earlier, I had a few comments.
Go ahead.
One, I wanted to let people know that the California Lyme Disease Association is having its second annual Lyme Patient Conference on April 24th. It's in San Ramon, and if people can go to lymedisease.org and click on conference registration. And they can get information about that if they're interested.
Okay, very good.
And I wanted to disagree with your characterization as Lyme as a walk in the park compared to...
tertiary syphilis?
Syphilis.
Okay.
Well,
go ahead and disagree.
Keynote speaker at this conference will be Dr. David Mart, who...
Okay, I'm asking you to be a little bit succinct here. Okay.
Okay. He had a diagnosis of ALS. He was decreasing very, very rapidly, and it was suggested that he might have Lyme disease. And he treated, and he's really better now.
And your point
is, well, ALS is not a walk in the park.
But he didn't have ALS. He had Lyme disease that was misdiagnosed as ALS, and you've never seen a case of tertiary syphilis. So with all due respect, and I understand you have an enormous commitment and do a lot of community work for this disease, and I totally respect that, but I have to say that I stand by my statement. It's a comparative statement. Don't be offended that I'm saying that Lyme disease is a good thing to have.
Well, Lyme
disease... I'm saying that there are some diseases that are actually worse.
Well, Lyme disease can also cause any kind of psychiatric or exacerbate any kind of psychiatric illness.
Okay, so you've disagreed, and I'm going to go ahead into the next call.
Can
okay?
I just say one more
comment? One more quick thing, yes.
When you're talking to people who say they have Lyme disease and you said you can't, you know, you can't talk them out of that,
mm-hmm.
I would suggest that another approach might be to suggest that antibiotics is not the only thing that's needed in treating Lyme disease. That all the doctors that I know who are really, you know, focused on this disease. Well, I went to a conference.
Okay, you're not being succinct,
okay,
Judith. We got
other
people waiting.
Well, that they need other things. That's my basic thing.
Thank you.
A lot of the approaches that you offer would be important.
All right,
as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye bye. And we're going to talk to. I wanted to get Kira on here. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I have a question about Lyme disease because I had Lyme disease diagnosed in 1993, and I was treated with a course of antibiotics, doxycycline,
mm-hmm.
and I was fine. My knees and swelling, the arthritis, everything went away. But in 2000, I lost my sense of smell, pretty much maybe like 80% of it, and my feet went numb. And here it is 10 years later. The symptoms haven't changed. They've not gotten any worse. And the neuropathy is in a unusual place. It's not where it's typically. So I just wanted to ask, should I be concerned or should I just accept that it's part of, and just move on?
Well, there are many different reasons you could have neuropathy, but having a distant past medical history of Lyme disease, you might want to explore the possibility that you could have residual central nervous system Lyme. That will require a spinal tap to disprove. So you know, everybody gives a big gulp. I have personally had a spinal tap, a lumbar puncture. They're really not that painful when they're done properly, which this one was. I've had worse menstrual cramps. It was not a big deal. So that might be the way to go. An infectious disease specialist can give you some information about that. Not knowing the specifics of your neuropathy, there are many other causes that need to be looked at. And I don't know whether the sense of smell could have just gone away. Sometimes it does for reasons we don't know. But, you know, the two together, hitting about the same time, they're weird. And we certainly know that late Lyme disease can have all kinds of weird manifestations. So maybe they didn't get it all. Maybe there's a little bit still sitting there in the central nervous system. And like I said,
and the only way to diagnose that was my question.
Yeah, lumbar puncture.
Okay, one more question which relates to that. I'm 63 now, mm-hmm. and I'm going to be retiring, but I'm not eligible for Medicare for 2 more years. Is there any place that a person who is in that little space can apply for lower-cost health insurance?
Are you kidding? No, of course not. That's the reason we're in this big process of transition, is because of the absurdity of this situation you've just described, where your personal movement and choice of when to retire and everything has to be calculated against your health insurance risk and the risk of losing it. Is there any way that you can get the lumbar puncture done before you retire while you still have health insurance?
I probably would do nothing because my symptoms have been stable for 10 years now, and the only way I would actually go and seek more treatment is if they began to get worse. But it's been stable.
I know, but the thing is that what's been stable is the tip of the iceberg that you can see above the water. If I had CNS Lyme, I'd want to treat it. I wouldn't want to just sit there and assume, well, it's all fine, nothing's going to go wrong. Lumbar puncture, like I said, it's a relatively simple procedure. You could find out. You might want to stay at your job for another year and while you're getting treatment with IV antibiotics if it turned out to be positive, just to keep your health insurance. What you don't want is
I have another, like a typical American case. My company was affected by the bank meltdown. My company is just about going under. It's not really a choice. My insurance will be terminated at the end of the month at my company sold.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
that's a very, very helpful suggestion. I had never considered that there were tests you could do to tell whether the oral doxycycline caught it all or not.
You are entitled to COBRA.
Right.
So you might actually want to go forward. Mostly what you're doing is you're getting a lumbar puncture and you're finding out that you don't have Lyme disease in the CNS, which is by far the most likely thing, and then you're done.
Okay.
All right? So rather than taking the worst case scenario, take the best case scenario. You've got the reassurance, and you know that you're taking some risks going bare for 2 years, but that's what you have to do.
Right. Well, thank you. That's been very helpful.
Good luck.
Okay.
Bye-bye. We're going to go to Gary in Watsonville. Hello, Gary.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Good. I really like your program, and I'm ready to take notes.
Okay,
evidently,
good.
You've talked about Dupuytren's contracture before.
Right.
And I am blessed with it.
Mm-hmm. How bad is it?
Number 5 in the right. It's my little finger's been curling for, it's about 25% curled. Mm-hmm. And you can see the tendon sticking up in the right hand. And the left hand, number 4 and 5 are curling. And it's, 25, maybe 20%, both fingers. And I have an appointment with the VA in Palo Alto, and I would really not like to have surgery. I was online, and I inquired. There was something about a needling technique.
Right, the needle aponeurotomy technique. Well, I think you've already gotten your information fairly straightforward. There is an alternative procedure that's called needle aponeurotomy, as opposed to open aponeurotomy, which is what they do with the surgery.
Needle apo?
Aponeurotomy. A-P-O-N-E-U. And
N-E-U.
Yeah, Google will find the rest of it for you. It'll R-O-T-O-M-Y. Yeah. Neurotomy. It's spelled like it sounds. And that procedure is, as far as I know, not available in the United States. It is available in Canada.
Uh-huh.
If you're looking to the VA for your health care, you're not going to get it here. The standard of care and what is covered by your veterans insurance would be the open procedure, which is a surgical release.
Uh-huh.
And the surgical releases are fairly straightforward as surgeries go and quite effective. So I don't think they're a bad thing. They do leave you with a nasty-looking scar on your hand, but hey, you could say you got it in... How old are you?
I could say I got it organic gardening.
You could say you got it at the first Gulf War. I mean, whatever. But anyway, point is, that's what's covered right now. That might be your best move. If you have the discretionary income to seek out one of these practitioners, most of them train in France and are in the French-speaking part of Canada. I think there's at least two people doing that procedure. Seems a very effective procedure.
Oh, it is effective?
They've got published data that looks pretty good.
Uh-huh.
But again, it's all in foreign language. I read French, so the French data looks good.
Okay, but it is pretty successful.
Yeah, we have a link on our website about it. If you go to my website, askdrdawn.com, you can find a link that will describe the procedure and help you find someone who's doing it. And the link is about Dupuytren's and also talks about this procedure.
AskDrDawn.com.
Yeah. Thank you. Say that again.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.